The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Chow. On the show this week,
the optimists also tended to have quite a hectic social life, so they were partying just as hard as they were working.
All you optimists, put down those cocktails and stop smiling. Pay attention. I'll be talking to Professor Elaine Fox about her new book, Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, A Journey into the Science of Optimism and Pessimism. It might be worth it, then again, it might not. And,
you know, when you begin to look at magic, magic is all about toying with perception and the mind.
Who said scientists don't believe in magic? I'll be talking to Alex Stone, a Harvard physics graduate whose love of magic led him to compete in the Magic Olympics. Yes, they have one for magicians. And also to a book called Fooling Houdini, a celebration of the psychological and mathematical brilliance of the magician's art. Ian Sample will be here to discuss some of this week's big science news, including a dogged attempt in the House of Lords to right a tragic wrong done to the British scientist Alan Turing, and how to turn a rat into a jellyfish. It'll all become clear a bit later. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Elaine Fox is a professor of cognitive psychology at the University of Essex and author of Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain. Her work focuses on the relationship between cognitive functions and our emotional states, specifically the nature of optimism and pessimism. Elaine looked on the sunny side of things when we contacted her to talk about her new work. I started by asking her, in cognitive psychology terms, what optimists and pessimists actually are.
An optimist is usually somebody who really does a lot of positive thinking and is very positive about their future. But from a scientific point of view, what I realised when I was writing the book was that there's actually a number of quite different components to optimism and to pessimism in addition to positive thinking. And in particular, one of the key elements is to do with control, a sense of having control. Optimists are people who tend to have a real sense that they have some control over their lives, that they can make an impact in terms of the things that happen to them. Whereas sometimes an overly pessimistic mindset is associated with the idea that things just happen out there randomly in the world and there's not very much I can do about it. So that element of control is actually really quite an important component of optimism. And interestingly, sometimes this view of control is actually an illusion. But nevertheless, it does seem to be of benefit to people. So there's some quite nice experiments, for example, where lights are just flashed on randomly in a particular sequence and people are asked to press buttons. And what you find is that optimists have a tendency to believe that they have some degree of control over the lights coming on and off through pressing buttons, whereas pessimists tend to be a lot more realistic in a sense. They're more accurate when they're looking at their own control. And actually, it's random for everybody. Nobody actually has any control over the lights coming on or off. So that element of control does seem to be quite important. And it's that element of control, a lot of scientific research now shows, has actually got a lot of health benefits and benefits in a whole range of ways.
Well, let's go into some of those benefits in a second. But before we do, I mean, the idea of being in illusory control of your life, if you're an optimist, it might make you feel better, but that can't be an advantage, surely.
I think it is an advantage in that, I mean, one of the functions of optimism, in a sense, is that it's really what gets us up in the morning and keeps us going and doing things.
During the daily grind, you mean?
Exactly.
Gets us through the boring bits.
It absolutely does. It gets us through the boring bits. It gets us through difficult times in particular. And the reality is, you know, for most people, lots of good things happen, but lots of bad things happen as well. And often, you know, the more successful people tend to be very good at dealing with setbacks. So I think that this idea of having a sense that actually there is something you can do, things are in your own control, kind of leads into this idea that you should just keep trying harder. And of course, that's another element of optimists, that they tend to be highly persistent. So really, I think what I tried to bring through in the book is it's not just about positive thinking. It's actually about persistence, control, and most of all, positive actions. It's actually the actions that are really important in optimism.
And what are these health benefits then? Well, what can being an optimist help you with?
Well, there's a whole range of health benefits. There's a couple of interesting studies that have been done. One was a very famous study now, which was done in a nursing home in the United States. And they were quite interested to see whether elderly residents in this nursing home would benefit by having a small amount of control over their lives. And what they did was they divided people randomly, very well-controlled scientific study. They randomly picked people on the fourth floor of this nursing home and people on the third floor. And everybody on both floors got a plant, which was theirs as a present. And they were also given a movie they could watch during the week. But the difference was that the people on the fourth floor were given control over when they looked after the plant. So if it needed to be watered, they would do that themselves, or they would ask someone to do that. And they could choose which night of the week they could watch their movie. Whereas the people on the third floor also had a plant, also had a movie, but they were told when they could see their movie, and a nurse or one of the staff looked after their plant. Now, the researchers followed people for several years after this, and they were amazed to find that not only were there huge health benefits in terms of physical health of people who had some control, but even the lifespan was actually quite different. After about 2 years, they were quite shocked when they came back and found that actually there was quite a difference in the number of people who had died on the floor who hadn't had control. So there's a lot of evidence.
Do we know the mechanisms for that? I mean, are there any suspicions about what it could be behind it?
Well, there's a whole range of things. I mean, certainly, again, there's some other evidence suggests that the immune system definitely functions better in people who are more optimistic. It's a slightly complex story. And again, a psychologist called Susan Segerstrom has done some very interesting work on this. She has worked primarily with law students in the United States and has really looked at people who are optimistic and people who are very pessimistic. What she finds is in the first year in law school, people who are more optimistic actually do worse in terms of their health. So all of their markers of, you know, biological risk go down a little bit. They tend to get more colds and flu and that kind of thing. But in the second year and the third year, the benefits to their health actually increase quite dramatically. And what she realised was going on was that in the first year, optimists tend to do a lot more. So they tended to work very, very hard, just as most law students do, especially in the States. But the optimists also tended to have quite a hectic social life. So they were partying just as hard as they were working.
They wanted to access everything.
They wanted to access everything, exactly. And so in the first year, that actually did have a negative impact on their health and their immune system was down a bit. But by the second year, of course, what had happened was that they had a very strong social network and there was a huge range of friends and they tended to have far more friends and you know, much closer social networks than the pessimists did. And it was that ultimately leads to the better health benefits. And I think that's one of the things that we know is that if you have a very good social network and some very good close friends, that can be a huge benefit, particularly when things go wrong. And optimists are people who do tend to have wider social networks and often closer friends. So that's definitely one of the mechanisms through which probably there are a lot of health benefits.
Now, we've been talking about optimists. Now, are all of these wonderful benefits and successes not available to pessimists then?
Well, no, absolutely not. And I think, again, one of the things in Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain that I tried to emphasise is that, you know, the world isn't black and white like that. We don't have optimists and pessimists who inhabit totally separate universes. Obviously, we all have a mixture of both. I mean, I think people are generally either optimistic or pessimistic. But I have a friend, for example, who's extremely optimistic about her job prospects. She's very successful. She's doing very well. But she's extremely pessimistic about finding a husband, for example, or finding a long-term partner. So I think, you know, a lot of us may be optimistic in some elements of our lives and pessimistic in others. But again, I think one of the things that I try to bring through in the book is that at the root of all of these mindsets, my argument really is that it's to do with the ancient fear system and the ancient pleasure system in our brain. So we have to ask, you know, why do we have these two different mindsets? And ultimately, it's about getting good balance between the two. And I think a lot of people think, well, our fear system is a negative thing. We should try and suppress fear as much as we can. But I think
when we need it.
Well, exactly. And that's one of the main points I make is that we actually fear is there for a very good reason. If we didn't have a fear system, we would have constant accidents. And I have tested people, for example, who've had strokes and brain damage and have damaged the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that deals with fear. And it's very interesting. The people with amygdala damage often live very, very normal lives. You wouldn't know there was anything particularly wrong. But what they've lost is this sense of fear. So if a hot coal fell out of the fire, they would pick it up, for example. So even though intellectually they know very well it's going to burn them, but because they don't have that natural fear response, it doesn't stop them from picking up.
Doesn't that cognitive part of their brain overrule the fact that they're not scared?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, one of the people I talk about in the book, who I tested over a number of years, called Linda, she had had amygdala damage. And she said it was a very strange feeling. She found it quite hard to explain, but she said that she absolutely knew that something would hurt and would damage her, but she just felt it, just didn't care. It was almost like as if she had taken a drug or something.
You talk about these two sort of things being hardwired. At what level is it hardwired? Is it a neurological thing? Is it a cognitive thing, or is it something more genetic?
Well, I think, again, I tried to look at and all of those things in a sense, and I think things are hardwired to some extent, but actually another point I'm really making very strongly is that things are actually very malleable. We can change these brain circuits.
They're hardwired and malleable at the same time.
Well, yeah, no, I don't really argue they are hardwired at all, actually. I think it's one of those easy phrases, but I think actually what I'm saying is that they're very difficult to change. So even though they're malleable, it doesn't mean it's easy to change, but I think there is the possibility there of change. But we certainly know that genes are definitely involved in tipping the balance. So people do differ in terms of how responsive they are to both negative things and to positive things. So if you take the pleasure system, for example, some people get a greater kick out of a lot of pleasurable activities than others. And sometimes what you find is even a very slight difference in brain time can actually make quite a big difference. It really does kind of escalate over time. So part of what I'm really arguing is that if you have a slight bias, say, towards something negative, over time that bias really just builds and builds and builds in your brain, and it's almost like you're training your brain to focus on the negative rather than the positive.
Is this a bias from birth in some respect?
Well, more or less, yeah, right from the beginning,
in the way your brain it develops, or is it genes?
Exactly. Certainly there are some genes. I've done a lot of work, for example, with a gene called the serotonin transporter gene, which we know is a gene that tunes people into elements of their environment, particularly emotional elements of the environment. And there's a lot of evidence that particularly in highly negative and threatening environments, people with a certain version of that gene tend to be a little bit more reactive. So even though the difference may not be huge, it may just be often in terms of fractions of a second, in terms of how quickly people respond to, say, negative things. Nevertheless, over time, if you think of a day in a week, in a month, in a year, and years of life, it really is that training really does escalate and becomes a much stronger circuit and a much more entrenched circuit in the brain.
Now, I can hazard a guess at this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I think I'm definitely an optimist. I think I've always been pretty optimistic.
Too.
Would you?
I would have guessed that too. But so did you ever start wondering, I need to be a bit more realistic or pessimistic about things?
I try to be kind of realistic about things. I think obviously, I think I generally do take a fairly optimistic view of things. And I think, again, a lot of it is to do with the time frame you're looking at as well. I suppose in the longer term, I'm definitely very optimistic. But often when I'm looking at shorter term goals, sometimes I get quite pessimistic about things. If you apply for a new job or a grant, for example, which I'm currently looking for lots of funding. And, often it's very easy to become quite pessimistic in terms of getting funding.
But being a scientist, though, isn't it?
That's just being a scientist, exactly. It's a normal everyday life of being a scientist, I think. But I think overall, I'm pretty optimistic. And of course, you can see why optimism is so functional in that sense, because it would be very hard sometimes to keep going if you didn't have that overall sense that in the end, it'll all be fine. And
is there any study anywhere showing that actually overall optimists do better in life, because they do end up just trying harder and all of that?
Yes, there is. There's a lot of research actually showing exactly that. A lot of research in the business world, for example, out in the real world, has shown that optimists do tend to be a little bit more successful. Also, there's some really nice laboratory-based studies just showing that the mechanism there is probably the greater persistence. So again, a very simple experiment asked people to solve anagrams, and they presented one impossible anagram, and the outcome measure was simply how long people would take to try and solve this anagram before they gave up. And what they found is, again, just with a normal student population, people who reported they were more optimistic tended to spend at least 2 minutes longer on trying to solve the impossible anagram than pessimists. So this idea of kind of persistence does seem to be a really important element of it. And of course, Thomas Edison famously said to the guy who invented the light bulb, he apparently went through thousands and thousands of things that didn't actually work. And he made this famous statement saying that, we haven't failed. We've we've never really failed. We've only found 10,000 ways that don't work. So I think that's the kind of attitude that often you find with optimists, which I think is why often they are quite successful in business.
Elaine Fox, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Rainy Brain, Sunny Brain, The New Science of Optimism and Pessimism is published by William Heinemann and is available in all good bookshops. Now, Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent, joins me to look at some of this week's science news. Ian, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
I think I have a bit of both. I'm generally optimistic, but then I do find myself worrying about things which no one else seems to worry about.
So you're optimistic in the face of tragedy and horror?
No, I think in the face of tragedy and horror, I tend to feel quite low. How about you?
I feel really happy. Shall we start with the stories? Now, the first story we're going to talk about is the ongoing campaign to pardon Alan Turing, the father of computing and a hero, a British hero of the Second World War. Now, the campaign's been going on for several years now and was recently stepped up with the introduction of a private members' bill in the House of Lords. The bill calls for Parliament to take action in this centenary year of the birth of Turing, who was convicted of gross indecency with another man in 1952 when these sexual encounters were unlawful. The bill's being led by Lord Sharkey, a Liberal Democrat peer, who lobbied the government unsuccessfully back in February for a pardon. Now, Alan Turing has been considered for a pardon by the Labour government in 2009. And as a result of that campaign, the then Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, he issued an unequivocal posthumous apology on behalf of the government, describing Turing's treatment as horrifying and utterly unfair. So I spoke to Lord Sharkey to find out just a little bit more about the latest stage in the campaign.
Well, the bill has one simple purpose, which is to grant a pardon to Dr. Turing, and if it becomes law, that's exactly what it will do.
And so this was recently, the idea of pardoning Dr. Turing came up again recently, actually, and it was sort of dismissed by the government as not appropriate. Why do you think that your bill might be more successful, or why have you continued with your actions?
Well, I think there's a difference between government and Parliament. This bill is a means for Parliament to decide to pardon Alan Turing. I think there is probably, if we're lucky, enough support within both houses of Parliament to make that happen.
So what needs to happen to actually enact this now? Can you just tell us a bit more about
it? The bill has to go through the normal stages in the House of Lords, and then it goes to the Commons and goes through the normal stages in the House of Commons. But the bill is a very simple and clear bill, and because I think there's widespread support for the intention behind the bill, with a bit of luck, and having the government look upon it at least neutrally, there is a good chance.
Now, it can be argued that Alan Turing's legacy is assured in history. He's a hero. He's a father of computing. Yeah. Why do you think we need to pardon him as well?
Well, because I think of the gross injustice done to him. I mean, he was a heroic Briton. He achieved enormous things for the country. He was treated extremely badly by the establishment and by the country. And I think we need to do something about it.
And do you have a timetable? How long will it take before we hear the results?
That's impossible to say. I mean, we will move as fast as we can. But it does depend on parliamentary timetables and other legislation. So we really don't know. But we do. I mean, I would be very pleased if it were to happen before the end of the year, because, of course, it's the centenary of his birth.
Lib Dem peer Lord Sharkey there, who's leading the campaign to try and get Parliament to pardon Alan Turing. Ian, a quick comment from you. How do you feel about this campaign and this sort of vehement attempt to get a pardon for Alan Turing?
I think most people want to see this succeed. I think most people want that pardon to happen. But, it's very obvious that it brings about, you deal with an injustice in a way that gives you then a real inconsistency in the legal system and this awkward inconvenience of, just because we know who Alan Turing was, does he deserve justice more than anybody, even if it's posthumous? And so you have this, it sets an awkward precedent. Do you now, whenever laws are changed, you go back retrospectively and adjust lots of criminal cases that have happened before, which is just impractical and not going to happen? So I think it's an enormously difficult thing to do practically, but if purely symbolically, quashing it would obviously be a nice thing to do.
But never mind that. I'll sign the campaign to get him pardoned. I mean, his contributions to the lives of millions of people today, billions of people today, is unquestioned.
But that doesn't make him more worthy of justice than anybody else.
It really doesn't. But it would be nice, wouldn't it? Should we move on to some science now? I'm going to read the first line of a story you wrote last week, and I want you to take it from there. Scientists have created an artificial jellyfish that uses heart cells from a rat to propel itself through the water.
Indeed. Well, this is work by a whole bunch of scientists. One of them that I spoke to was Kit Parker at Harvard, and they've essentially created a really small, this is about as big as a penny, maybe a dime in the US, about a centimeter across, artificial jellyfish from silicone. Actually, it's a structure with several arms that radiate from it. And this silicone is coated with rat cells in a particular pattern, rat heart cells in a particular pattern. And when you put this into a solution which has water and ions in and glucose and things like that, and stick a voltage across it, an alternating current across it, you can get this thing to swim because you make the cells fire and it survives and it swims along. And it mimics a lot of the movement of a natural jellyfish, which they studied juvenile moon jellyfish exquisitely to look at how they worked before basically reverse engineering it into this silicone form.
Now, before we go on and discuss the implications, let's hear a bit from Kit Parker in one of the most fantastic scientist videos you've ever seen. He basically is the modern scientific Chuck Norris.
My name's Kit Parker. I'm a member of the disease biophysics group at Harvard, and several years ago we had an idea that we could build a jellyfish out of a rat. The reason why we're interested in doing this is we want to understand muscular pumps, and we look at the jellyfish as a very simple model of how the heart pumps. What we do in our engineering group is try to use engineering to gain fundamental insights into biological phenomena. And in this case, while some engineers build things out of steel, copper, and 3-5, we build things out of cells. Cells are our building substrate.
So that was one of the scientists behind this remarkable piece of research, Kit Parker. Ian, you spoke to Kit Parker. Is he as wonderfully clear and Chuck Norris-like in the phone?
He's a very interesting and very funny character. It's actually one of the first video Skype interviews I've done from the office here with someone. And halfway through the interview, he got up and walked away. And I thought, okay, I'll just keep talking. And then he came back holding, brandishing even, a physiology book. And he waved it at the camera of his computer saying, there may be things in here we need to rewrite because we've learned stuff about heart cells and how they work as pumps that we didn't know before. And he also, this is not a small man. This is, imagine, he's not fat, but he's a big guy. And I asked him to explain to me how this synthetic artificial jellyfish moves. And he proceeded to show me with his whole body using his arms as the what we would call the legs, but the protrusions, and it was wonderful, no doubt about it. But he's a very interesting guy. I first asked him why he did the work, he said, "Ian, there are too many rats, too few jellyfish."
I mean that's good enough for me, to be honest. But let's drill down into this more scientifically, which is the kind of direction that we want to go in our coverage. So why scientifically is this interesting? Why would you want to create an artificial jellyfish from bits of rat?
So the long-term goal of the group and the ones they're working with is to build up to the point where you can use heart cells and tissue engineering techniques to try and recreate organs. In this case, you would be looking at trying to recreate a heart. So, you know, sort of enormous, relatively speaking, compared to the size of cells, a big, pumping sort of structure here. But sort of, and that's their final aim. But what they're doing is they're starting off with very simple organisms like this baby jellyfish, and moving on up to more complex organisms. They're working their way up the food chain, essentially. So they're going to look at animals that move in more complex ways. So you can think of like octopus and things like that. And so they're going through like the marine organisms, it appears. And with each step in that, they hope that they're really going to just learn an awful lot more about how do you use these cells to make structures that have physical properties that will beat in a certain way, that will move in a certain way, and incorporate different types of cells in those as well. Because bear in mind that this was very simple. This is basically silicone with heart cells on, but in a living structure, you really want more cell types than that. So it's they're at the very bottom of a steep mountain here, but that's the end game for where they're going.
So in fact, what they want to do is rebuild hearts, fix damaged heart tissue, rather than build marine animals from mammals.
Yeah, I don't think that's unless they get an awful lot of money from some sort of
Dr. Evil character.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they'll start making they'll drift off with a spin-out company and do that.
And so building these animals is just a way for them to test various modes of operation and understand more about the heart cells. I mean, it's a very interesting subject, generally speaking. The idea that you can actually regrow heart cells is new. It's only in the last few years that this has even been thought possible. Given the amount of heart disease in the world, it's a pressing problem as well. In the past, if your heart has gone wrong, you have to replace it, essentially.
There's some interesting stuff in how they did it, because in a way it can seem kind of, it's easy to see this as a sort of trivial stunt, and I think that's kind of underestimating. I mean, what they did is they studied these jellyfish enormously, looking at how they work, how the sort of muscle fibers work in those, how the physiology works. And what they recreated, you can't just put the rat heart cells on the silicone and it'll work. It's not, you know, and you jolt it in a Frankenstein way and it's off. These heart cells had to be patterned so their orientation was in a specific direction. And you do that by patterning the silicone with proteins that really act as road signals for the heart cells. So when you lay them down, they're growing in a very coherent way, that they're going to talk to each other in the proper way. They'll be efficiently linked together. And this is the kind of thing that you really need to learn. And there was one nice aspect of this work which shows that they did learn some, really find out properly what they were doing, and that when they recreate the swimming motion of this jellyfish, okay, it swims like the natural type of jellyfish, but it also does this lovely thing where at the end of a stroke it creates these vortices behind it. If you think of a jellyfish moving, where it kind of looks essentially like a sort of a flat disc or maybe a slight bell shape, and then it contracts in and propels itself upwards or forwards, it creates vortices at the end which the jellyfish in real life uses to sort of waft nutrients into its mouth, which is in the underneath. And they've recreated that just by, you know, the way they produce this. And I think it shows that they're learning very well how natural organisms work, and then really translating that over into these synthetic things pretty closely.
Okay, thanks a lot, Ian, for that. For more information on that, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And if you want to know more about the heart, of course, you can listen to our podcast from November last year, where we spent a good 45 minutes or so discussing every possible new regenerative medicine technique all about the heart. And that's on the iTunes feed. Or you can go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. The word magic is often a major turn-off for fans of science, professional or amateur. But for the writer and physicist Alex Stone, his childhood passion for disappearing coins and endless reams of colourful handkerchiefs would eventually lead to a scientific understanding of the magician's craft. In time, that fascination would also lead him to practicing magic at a high level himself. Alex combined and chronicled his two loves in a new book, Fooling Houdini, and, as if by magic, Alex is on the line from New York to speak to us now. Alex, welcome to the program. Now,
thanks.
Your book is about the sort of mathematics, psychology, interplay of all those things with magic. So let's just start by getting a definition from you. What is magic?
I think I'll defer to an old saying by the godfather of modern magic, Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin, who said the magic is essentially a form of cheating for amusement. It's a form of deception designed to entertain.
Okay. And so how did you get into it? I mean, you're a self-professed physics lover in the book. So where did magic come from in your interest?
Well, actually, I got interested in magic when I was five, and my father bought me a magic kit.
So that was actually first.
When he was on a trip. And, you know, it was one of those little kids' kits with like a little goblet that you can make a ball vanish and a little wooden box that would change coins from, you know, pennies to nickels, little foam rabbits that could be made to multiply in your hands. And my first show, my debut performance was my own sixth birthday party, and it went terribly. It was a disaster. My audience heckled me. But years later, I discovered this subculture of magicians, and it's a very fascinating world of deception and secrecy, with bizarre rituals and secret societies and tournaments and conventions. There's even a Magic Olympics that takes place every 3 years. Actually, just happened in Blackpool, England, ended on the 14th of this month. And I became intrigued with this world because, first of all, it was filled with really curious, quirky, and often brilliant people. And I also found that there were a lot of connections to science, and I'm a science writer. I have a background in physics. You know, when you begin to look at magic, magic is all about toying with perception and the mind. So you start to ask some very interesting questions about how we perceive the world. What are the, you know, how much of the world do we perceive, and how much of what we perceive is an illusion? What are the effects of secrecy? How does secrecy affect our lives? Why do we sometimes take pleasures in deceiving others and at times in being deceived? What does it mean that humans are so inclined to believe in the supernatural? How do horoscopes work? So these are questions that relate to magic, but also to our daily lives. And I think that's really what ended up holding my fascination and fueling my fascination with magic, was this idea that it teaches us something about what it means to be human.
Now, that all sounds very compelling, but how do you actually start to attack that from a scientific point of view? Who are the scientists who are doing this work?
Well, there's quite a few, actually. I mean, there's even a group right now of neuroscientists in Arizona at the Barrow Neurological Institute, which is the oldest independent neuroscience institute in the country, who are teaming up with magicians and actually running experiments where they see how people experience magic tricks and use it to study perception. And they'll look at exactly, you know, they'll use eye-tracking tools, for instance. And they're not the only ones who've done this. There's other groups who've used eye-tracking tools to see how people perceive magic tricks and actually looking at their brains to see how it works. Other experiments have used the techniques of magic to see what we miss. For instance, you know, they'll do an experiment where they'll distract someone and then they'll show something very obvious. You know, one famous example is the gorilla video, which is, I don't know, for those not familiar with it, it's this video where they show people passing a ball around and viewers are instructed to count the number of passes. And then midway through the video, a woman in a gorilla suit walks across the screen, beats her chest, and then walks off screen. And I mean, this is essentially a magic trick. I mean, you can imagine the gorilla being like, you know, the woman in the ball, you know, the secret of some illusion, and the basketballs are like the showgirls. I mean, it's the exact same principle of misdirection and distraction. And what they find is that more than half of the people don't see the gorilla. This is an example of inattentional blindness. And I actually did an experiment with the woman who coined that term at the New School in New York. She did some of the seminal research in this field, where we brought people in and we stole their watches while distracting them with a coin trick. And we found that, you know, 4 out of 5 people didn't notice when I took their watches off. So this is just one example. I mean, there's many, there's some, for instance, with false memories. A while back, a magician gave a lecture where he demonstrated a bunch of tricks and then only described one trick where a coin vanishes from one side of the room and appears at the other. And then a week later, they asked the students to recall the tricks, and most of them remembered actually seeing the coin vanish from one side of the room and appear at the other, meaning that, you know, this is an example of false memories, which is, there's a whole literature on that as well. So there's many examples of scientists using the techniques of magicians to study the mind. And then a lot of these psychological experiments are essentially magic tricks. I mean, another great example is the same guy who did the gorilla video, Daniel Simons. He did an experiment where he had researchers stop pedestrians on the street and ask for directions. Midway through the conversation, a couple stooges, Confederates, walked between them with like a door or something blocking their view, and one of the Confederates switches places with the researcher who'd asked directions, so that moments later the pedestrian is now talking to a completely different person. And again, they found that more than half of people don't notice. You know, magicians exploit this all the time, but there's a vast scientific literature on the fact that our memories are subject to distortion at all levels. I mean, scientists, they've done experiments where they've, in mock crime scenes, you know, changed the colors of cars or witnesses and have remembered all kinds of false things. They've even, through the power of suggestion, been able to implant early memories of early traumas and being lost in a supermarket and animal attacks and even memories of before, you know, of in early childhood, before the age of two, which no one remembers anything before that. So it's been estimated, and this is a profound impact on our criminal justice system, and it's been, by one estimate, as many as 90% of wrongful convictions are due to eyewitness misidentification. And a lot of police procedures, sketch artists, police lineups, leading questions in interrogations have been shown to encourage false memories. So this is a serious problem with the criminal justice system because a lot of these methods, a lot of these conventional methods can distort our memories. And the deeper philosophical message from all this is something that philosophers of the mind have been suggesting for a long time, which is that reality and our perception of reality are incommensurate to a degree far greater than we tend to believe. That our brain fabricates, constructs a narrative of perception from these bits of data that we bring in through our senses, many of which are distorted, subject to embellishment, and incomplete and contradictory. And so, to some extent, this is the basis of this idea that, you know, which Daniel Dennett, for example, a philosopher of the mind, calls the illusion of consciousness, which is this idea that, you know, a lot of what we consider to be this. A lot of, you know, for all its richness and apparent fidelity and smoothness and continuity, and there's other, you know, experiments that show that our perception of reality is discontinuous or lags behind reality. You know, a lot of this thing that we perceive, our world, may be, you know, a magic trick that our brain is playing on.
Now, the picture you're painting of the attentional blindness and the false memories, I mean, in some senses, you know, a person coming across this for the first time might start to worry about the capacities of the human mind and our inability to sort of attend to things. But in a sense, that's exactly what you're using in magic tricks to make them enjoyable. So why is it that even when you know all this stuff, magic tricks are so enjoyable? Because all they do is point out that you've not been paying attention.
There's two things to that. I mean, the first thing is that these cognitive glitches are sort of the flip side of what make our brain so powerful. Think about it as the fontanelle, the soft spot on a baby's head. The reason why all humans are born with soft spots is because our brains are so big, our heads are so big that, you know, they have to be a little bit malleable in order for us to be born. But, you know, and that's a good thing that we have such great, powerful, big brains, but also, you know, we have this little weakness when we're born. Well, our ability to focus for long periods of time on a lone task is a signal virtue of the human brain, you know, our attention. But the flip side of that is that we're prone to miss peripheral distractions. And that's, you know, one of the things that magicians exploit, and that's why we're going to miss certain things that happen. But, you know, it's a good thing that we're able to focus for so long on a task. That's what got us, you know, from flint napping to iPhones in, you know, 50,000 years. So, and as you suggested, a lot of times magic tricks still work, still entertain us, even when we know how they're done or we understand the principles behind them, because they exploit these mechanisms, these cognitive mechanisms that are ingrained in our brains that are universal. Again, I think that's one of the reasons why magic tricks transcend age and culture and gender, is because everybody basically has these psychological mechanisms, that they're basic human mechanisms, are native to how our brains work.
It sounds like an odd way around, perhaps. But if we learn more about how our brains function, do you think magicians can use some of that information to make even more spectacular tricks?
Yeah, I think so on some level. And I think they have, actually. I think magicians, though, have been informally experimenting with these principles for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's actually the scientists that are catching up kind of late. You know, in a sense, I feel as though magicians have intuitively known about these principles since magic began, you know, however many thousands of years ago. I do think now there's this slight bidirectionality, you know, where scientists are seeing how far they can push these in the lab and understanding on a more rigorous level how they work. And some of that has back-channeled into magic and I think improved their effects. Certainly in the mathematical side of things it has, perhaps more concretely, you know, new mathematical results have created new tricks. And that's, you know, but in the psychology, I think it's a little bit more that magicians have been doing it forever and they sort of instinctively know how these things work, and that now scientists are finally using them to understand on a more rigorous level how and why these things work, and to model experimentally what magicians seem to understand intuitively about the brain.
So science and magic, actually much better friends than we ever thought. Alex Stone, thank you very much indeed.
It was my pleasure.
Many thanks to Alex and all our guests this week, Professor Elaine Fox and Lord Sharkey. That's all we have for you for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.